Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. This is Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. We're taking a close look at Australia's buffalo industry today, turning wild buffalo roaming Arnhem Land in the Territory into income.
There's two issues that we have to look at. That is land management and the maximum utilisation of the buffalo. Not just shooting them to protect the environment, but perhaps mustering them, turning them off and developing an income.
So that's the live export side of things. We'll also take a look at the more traditional buffalo milk industry in Australia's south. That's coming up. And we'll remember Dinky, the singing dingo, who died earlier this year, a request from one of our listeners today on Bush Telegraph. Well, let's start by trying to find out if your mobile black spot is likely to be fixed next year. The federal government is spending $100 million and the aim is to improve mobile reception around Australia. If you were listening a couple of months back, you would have heard that there is a short list of some 6,000 locations that have been nominated as in need of better or some coverage. And now, essentially, we're waiting on the mobile phone carriers to say where they want to build the new towers with the help of a government subsidy. Paul Fletcher is the Parliamentary Secretary to the Communications Minister. Thanks for coming in again. Appreciate it.
Pleasure, Cameron.
How much closer are rural Australians to knowing if they're going to get mobile service or not?
Well, what we're announcing today is the commencement of the formal competitive selection process. That'll be the opportunity now for Telstra, Optus, Vodafone, and also potentially some specialist infrastructure companies to develop proposals as to where they would build base stations around the country with the benefit of this government subsidy. They're required to lodge their proposals by March the 16th, and then the government will assess them against all the criteria we've set out in the guidelines, and we aim to be in a position to announce the base stations that get funding by 30 June next
year. So you're close to getting a list of locations from the carriers, are you? From the
Well, that is the next step. So what they're now required to do under this competitive selection process, they start, as you rightly said, with the 6,000 or so locations around the country that have been nominated by Australians, and then we ask them to come up with their list of where they would build new or improved base stations. They need to tell us how much it's going to cost, how much they're going to put in, how much they want out of the fund, how many new premises would get coverage, how many square kilometres would get new coverage here, how many kilometres of road, of major transport route are going to get coverage. Mm-hmm. So that'll all get fed into the government. We will then go through and choose the ones that will get the tick from that list. So we could end up with a mix from different operators depending upon what they end up proposing. So the objective here is to have the process be competitive as between the three mobile network operators so that we get best value for taxpayers' money and drive this money as far as we can in getting as many base stations for the money. Mm-hmm. But secondly, also competitive as between locations so that we can choose the locations which give the best benefit overall.
So is that what's new today? You've basically got you've released the criteria of how you'll assess which ones get the nod and which don't.
Yes, what is new is, first of all, we've released the formal guidelines after developing them pretty extensively over the year and a lot of back and forth with the mobile network operators and other interested stakeholders such as state governments. But then the second thing that's new is the clock's now ticking for the operators to develop their proposals and to come forward by March the 16th.
When we spoke recently, you were quite clear that a key component of this will be the number of residences that are covered by a new tower and also the number of kilometres of road that's covered that you just mentioned again there. Is there anything new in addition to that that will be used to assess the benefit or the likelihood of a project going ahead, a tower being built?
Well, there's a range of factors that are set out. I think those are the major ones. One of the other ones that's relevant is that we've said if a federal member of parliament has nominated a location, they can nominate up to three locations, and each one that they nominate will get a certain amount of points in the process. Mm-hmm. We've done that because in our
Do these have to be rural locations? Am I right there?
Rural and regional, yes,
yep,
that's right.
Okay, yep.
So the reason we've done that is because people very often complain to their local members of parliament if the telecommunications network isn't up to scratch. So local MPs have a good repository of knowledge about what are the priority areas. I hasten to add that right to nominate is available to a member of parliament in any one of the relevant electorates. Doesn't matter whether they're Liberal, National, Labor, Independent, etc., etc. But it's just about picking up that community knowledge that a local MP will often have. Look, the other factor is value for money, so that numbers of square kilometres of coverage or numbers of premises then get weighed up against what's the dollars going in to the base station. Now, we're working on a figure on average across the country of $600,000 for a new base station, but it does vary. Mm-hmm. In some areas, it'll be less than that. For example, if it happens to be the case that there's an existing tower, for example, a government tower or a television broadcasting tower that an operator can use. On the other hand, a more remote site in remote parts of Queensland or Northern Territory or WA, for example, could easily be $1 million or $2 million. So the more remote they are, the more expensive they are.
But you're still working at an overall number of 250 to 300
yes,
towers.
Yes, that's right. That continues to be our estimate based upon previous programs, typically a bit smaller in scale, but previous such programs.
And how many of the black spots do you think will be addressed, the 6,000 that have been nominated, how many will be fixed with 250 to 300 towers?
Well, I guess we'll only ultimately know the question at the end of the process, but a couple of points on that. Firstly, we asked people to nominate the 6,000. We did not do any testing that they are, in fact, areas without coverage. Now, in many cases, they certainly are, but there will also be some that are in there which actually do have coverage on the standard measurements. The other factor, of course, is that quite a few of these black spots or these nominated locations are quite close to each other, so one base station could very well serve multiple locations. A relevant fact there, actually, is that the distance that you can go from a base station is affected by a number of factors, including the radio frequency spectrum. So lower frequencies give you longer distance. Now, both Telstra and Optus are about to introduce 700 megahertz spectrum. They purchased that at auction over the last year or two. They've spent a lot of money on it.
Is that low?
Hmm?
Is that low?
That is low, yeah. Yes. So as a reference point, so the traditional GSM, which has been around since the mid-90s, is in 900 megahertz. Mm-hmm. Quite a lot of other services are in 1800 megahertz. So 700 megahertz is low. So the relevance of that is that they've got some new tools to deploy, as it were, which should help them get a bit more distance from existing locations and new locations they're planning compared to what would have been possible previously.
Okay. So does that mean it's going to be harder for Vodafone to win any of the tender process if they've got the higher spectrum or the less distance, less punch in their coverage? Are they up against it?
Well, what I'd say is we've tried to set this up so that it's a competitive process and each of them will put the best foot forward referable to their own strategies and their own relative strengths. So perhaps I'll leave it to each of the operators to talk about that if they want to. And the first thing they've got to do is be doing their detailed homework, which I know they are all doing. Perhaps one other point to make there, though, is I talked briefly about so-called specialist network infrastructure providers. So these are companies like Crown Castle and Broadcast Australia, which own and operate towers for the mobile companies today, either the mobile companies or other companies in the communications sector. Now, we've invited them to come forward as well, and it may well be that they've got an appetite, for example, to build towers in places that the other companies don't. We want to find all of that out. The whole purpose of a competitive process is give us your best ideas and we'll work out what lets us get the most done with this amount of government money.
Will the public have access to the list of locations that the companies are putting forward, the carriers are putting forward? If people want to know if they're on the list or not, will they get the chance to see that?
Well, what they will certainly see is the list that ultimately emerges from the government process. So we'll make a decision based upon what the carriers have put forward. It'll be against these criteria that are set out in the guidelines.
But if I'm at Marie and I'm waiting to know if I've got any chance of getting mobile phone reception, I won't find out in advance if I'm not on any of the three carriers' lists, that I'm out of the equation.
Well, that's right. So the timing of the announcement process will be, we'll announce when there's a decision as to which locations have been funded. That being said, it is certainly open to community leaders and concerned citizens to be engaging with the mobile operators to say, for example, well, look, I'm in a location that's on the list of 6,000. You know, here are all the good reasons I reckon you should be including this in your bid. And I expect there will be a fair bit of that dialogue going on.
Okay, but then early in the new year, relatively early in the start of next year, people will have a good idea if they're going to get a tower or better mobile service.
The aim is that we'll be in a position to announce it by 30 June next year.
So people will know that. One quick question without notice. Parliamentary Secretary to the Communications Minister, got a view on the ABC cuts and this program going?
As the Communications Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, has made clear, number one, we do need to secure some efficiencies from the ABC and SBS, as from every other part of government. And number two, what Minister Turnbull has put a lot of work into is the Lewis Review, commissioned earlier this year from Peter Lewis, former Chief Financial Officer of the Seven Network, saying, well, look, what would in a commercial broadcaster, what would you do if you looked at the businesses of the ABC and SBS and said, how could we find efficiencies in a way that doesn't involve cuts to frontline services?
Mm. And would cutting this program represent a cut to a frontline service?
Well, I think there what I would say is operational decisions on which programs get funded and which don't are for ABC board and management. And it is important that we preserve that appropriate distinction, not least for editorial independence. You don't want politicians making programming decisions.
Okay. Thanks very much for coming in and taking those questions without notice. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Cameron.
Paul Fletcher, who is the Parliamentary Secretary to the Communications Minister. You are listening to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. Well, as we power on towards Christmas, there are some industries that are busier than others. One of those, reaching peak production, is the ham-making business, the curing, the smoking and the drying of pig meat. The Sankey family has been hand-making ham for 70 years, and there's an interesting side note to this, a quirk of history. The grandfather, Sankey, was a Polish immigrant Jew. Serena Locke has a tour of the ham and small goods factory in Sydney.
Hidden below inner Sydney high-rise flats is a team of 18 industrious people steadily trimming, salting, trussing, smoking and packaging. Factory manager Alan McClellan.
Hidden back from the main street, so probably most people don't know what happens here.
Pastoral Small Goods has been here for 70 years, owned by the same family, producing hams, corned beef, cabanossi and other small goods. Before we meet the family, we take a tour of the artisan butchers adeptly wielding super sharp knives.
We have our bone-in legs, the square-cut legs, as they've come from the abattoir.
So you're preparing a few bone-ins?
Yeah, bone-in hams, yep. Bone-in legs here. Just bone these ones out for a double smoke.
What products are you making here?
There's big lists. It's a big, very long list. So in small goods we make a Krainsky, we make a Cabana, Cabanossi. What else? We make a Pucchetta. Everything is done traditional way, and it's very clean and very, very actually healthy because it's not chemicals inside. We're actually another company, different company, using low premixes and chemicals. We use natural herbs and old-fashioned.
The brined meat for small goods is then put into a giant rolling steel tumbling barrel to rapidly cure the pork with the salt, proteins and nitrites. The Christmas hams are then hung out to dry and crammed in to the smoking rooms.
We generate smoke by grinding a log of beechwood, and in that grinding the smoke's emitted and then that's circulated throughout the smokehouse. It gives very, very good colour, very good flavour. And beechwood is widely used because it's a good quality wood that's also renewable timber.
At this time of year, Pastoral is turning out 30,000 tonnes of ham and small goods a week, but they have to charge for the labour-intensive nature of curing meat.
We certainly can't compete on price because the amount of product that's coming in from overseas, very large volumes. Quite often it's subsidised by the governments in which the countries that meat comes from. We have to compete on quality. So we're a smaller volume, more of an artisan quality operation.
I'm Jonathan Sankey. I'm third generation Australian small goods maker, but I think prior to that it was five or six, maybe even more, generations going back into Middle Europe in Poland.
With an odd detour.
An odd detour between Poland and Australia. There was Israel for a few years, and my grandfather not the most observant Jewish person, came to Australia to start a ham factory. I guess the ultimate liberation of coming to Australia. yeah, the ultimate freedom of choice, isn't it?
Did he start from scratch?
When he first came here, he spoke no English. He basically was fresh immigrant post-war. So he went and bought into this business here, which was also called Pastoral. So what my grandfather, I guess, did was bring more of a European flavour to it.
The Jewish grandfather is not the only odd chapter in the family's ham-making history. Jonathan Sankey is a graduate of business and law and says he's had a chance to visit some poorly run piggeries.
My ex-partner was a vegan animal rights lawyer. So you can imagine, and 5 years, you know, of being together, it was a very interesting dynamic. So, yeah. But, yeah, it really imparted to me because it was an industry that I didn't want to go into, the meat industry, because from, an animal cruelty perspective.
The modern small goods maker candidly says he wants to be at the forefront of better animal welfare. But he struggles to source free-range pigs because they're expensive.
Obviously, we want to go at free-range and all that. It's just that the cost is so exorbitant. And with our lack of economies of scale, since we are a small niche producer, we do struggle at times to do that because if we could, use non-Australian pork, we could get imported free-range pork that has been subsidised by Canada or Denmark, and then that would be a lot more advantageous for us. Unfortunately, there have been times that we've tried to do many things like this, but the price has been so prohibitive that no one would buy it. It's something that I'm very passionate about, as I always told, I think, my ex-partner in that regard, that it's better to have someone screaming from inside the industry than to be screaming at it from the outside like she was.
Jonathan Sankey is not only concerned about animal welfare, but he also wants to produce healthy small goods.
My dream and my goal is to have processed meat that's good for you, because processed meat is generally an evil thing, and I would agree with it. It's an evil thing from my experience, because the majority of, I know what goes into our stuff, obviously, because it's traditional recipe and it's all relatively quite basic in some regards, but there's other things like water binders where people can inject a ham and they can increase its weight by 80 to 120%, and how they do that is that they put in these things called water binders with chemicals which basically retain water into the meat. And the result of that is that you sell water for meat prices, and that's why hams don't have flavour, or they have a strange aftertaste, or they're flavourless, and all these things. But you get these huge margins on your products. Most processed meats do this, the majority. And that's why they're bad for you, and they are bad for you, you know, nutrition-wise. So I'm trying to change that and to do, you know, I'd love to do a superfood ham.
And indeed, there was a major European study last year involving 500,000 people, which linked high consumption of processed meats to early death from heart disease and cancer. The Sankey family is keen supporters of the pink square label saying Australian pork, because it can be traced back to the farm. And they've branched out into non-pork small goods, like this herb-crusted rare roast beef.
It's just so juicy and infused with herbs and paprika.
You know, that was my creation, the Italian rare. It's just got that right amount of drama to the product.
Larry Sankey and his son Jonathan ending very candid and forward-thinking. That was a Pastoral Small Goods with Serena Locke. You're listening to Bush Telegraph.
In part 5 of Love in the 90s...
alternative rock had become boring. It was time for a change, an alternative to alternative. This idea of sampling as a new urban folk music had already been seized upon by Beck.
Green Day, Garbage and Courtney Love are suddenly famous.
It shouldn't have worked. Alternative rock effectively became mainstream.
How did it affect the music?
Sometimes the music can be the enemy.
Streaming from Into the Music on the RN homepage.
Talking buffalo very soon on Bush Telegraph. The live export of buffaloes. It's an industry that's thought to offer hope for a new income source for Indigenous communities, particularly around Arnhem Land. So we'll be looking at that very soon. And we also remember Dinky. Dinky died earlier this year. Dinky was a singing, piano-playing dingo that was very well known to visitors of Central Australia. And one of you has asked for us to replay that story, so that's coming up very soon. First, though, Tony Allen has today's rural news. We've just been talking about ham and pork. I see our Australian industry is a little worried that the US wants to sell us their diseased pork. What's going on?
Yes, well, the Australia does not allow the import of fresh pork. However, 70% of the pork that we use in things like bacon, ham and salamis is brought in from overseas, but in a partly processed form.
Mm-hmm.
The Australian pig industry is now worried that as part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, the United States is pressuring the Australian government to accept fresh pork imports. Now, one of the reasons they're not allowed at the moment is because they can carry diseases like porcine epidemic virus, which has killed millions of pigs in the United States. And Deb Kerr from Australian Pork Limited claims that the US National Pork Industry Council is trying to get Australia to relax its biosecurity protocols.
Our pig herd is a closed herd, and if those sorts of diseases got into Australia, then it could absolutely devastate our herd in Australia. It's a people welfare issue. Pork producers are very concerned about their pigs, and so they see it quite rightly as a welfare issue as much as a rules issue.
So that's different, is it, than that diarrhoea disease that was causing problems?
Yeah, that's a different one.
That was pretty ordinary as well, wasn't it?
Pretty good selection of animal diseases out there.
Okay. The TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, that is an agreement that seems, or a negotiation, that gets more comment on our social media pages than any other trade negotiation.
Well, one of the things that Australia is now trying to do through that is to free up trade in sugar. So the Australian sugar industry is lobbying very hard on Europe and the United States on that. So, you know, it goes both ways.
Yeah, okay, we'll hear more of that down the track. Let's talk about Tasmania and fishing in Tasmania. People will know it as a fly fishing destination, but there's hopes that it will draw international fisher people to catch swordfish as well.
Yeah, there's a potential game fishing industry off the east coast of Tasmania. The local fishermen have been catching it as a commercial crop, not crop, that's the wrong word, commercial catch. But also they have proved, they say, that it is a viable industry and the swordfish are a viable population. And now there's state and federal governments have put in some funding to encourage businesses to set up game fishing tourism operations for the swordfish. Now, the average swordfish is about 3 metres long. It's related to the marlin. It is a prized game fish. And so lead researcher with the Institute of Marine and Antarctic Studies, Dr. Shorten Tracy, says this swordfish game fishing should attract international anglers.
They would be pretty much called the Mount Everest of recreational fishing. It's not a simple thing. You know, you have to go a long way out. You have to really work on your technique and get your baits right and get your gear right. And that's just to actually even hook one. And then it's a real skill to actually get them up to the boat as well. So, yeah, they're sort of the pinnacle of game fishing.
Okay, so interesting developments there. Now, I've been told I need to correct something here, not the fact that you've referred to swordfish as a crop. That one's gone through to the keeper. But apparently our audio there referred to a herd of pigs. Now, I'm told that a group of pigs is either a drift, a drove, a litter if they're young, a sounder of swine, a team, a passel, is it, of hogs? And singular is a group of boars. So,
Well, I'm not going to quibble with Australian Pork Limited calling it a herd.
Yeah, no, fair enough. All right, let's. What have we? We've ticked off the swordfish. We've ticked off pork. Shall we talk milk now?
Yeah. Well, I remember 25 years ago or so, I was in Tokyo and I was stunned to go into a big department store and find 3 Australian rock melons on sale for $100, gift wrapped. And
$100, 3 rock melons.
Yeah, and that was 25 years ago when you get a rock melon for a dollar here.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this gift thing is pretty interesting, the way they do it in Asia. Well, in China now, the trendy gift appears to be a bottle of milk, a bottle of fresh foreign milk. It sells for up to $12 a litre and is catching on as a generous gift among China's middle class. And the Australian milk industry is thinking they can capitalise on this, maybe by making gift milk packs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Skeen is the chief executive of Victorian Process at Camperdown Dairy, and he says the company has just started exporting to China, aims to sell 600,000 litres of fresh milk a month, and this new trend could work for them.
There's an interesting trend occurring that we're seeing now. In China, they're actually giving milk as a gift. They're seeing fresh milk as a luxury and gift-giving. We've had a look at a very large distribution business over there that 60% of their sales, for example, is around gifts all year round.
How do you think that'll go down if you gave someone a bottle of milk for Christmas?
Well, you wouldn't want it to go off in the fridge, would you? You'd have to drink it pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's certain parts of Australia, in the inner city set, that wouldn't mind, you know, almond milk, or there's a trendy soy milk brand, I think, that one of our producers has told me about once or twice.
I think they've got enough soy milk in China. I don't think that would work as a gift.
All right, thanks, Tony. We'll leave it there. Tony Allen with today's Rural News. You are listening to Bush Telegraph. Well, Indigenous leaders from across the Northern Territory, they've just been in Vietnam, and the idea was to get a better understanding of the newly established live buffalo trade. Vietnam has taken about 4,500 mostly farmed buffalo from Australia this year, but it turns out that importers want more. The demand's actually pushing up the price, which is creating an opportunity for remote Indigenous communities in Arnhem Land. The reason why is because that region of the territory is home to about 140,000 feral buffalo. From Haiphong, Matt Brand reports.
A live export ship carrying 400 buffalo from the Northern Territory is being unloaded in Haiphong, Vietnam. Standing on the dock and watching the process very closely is Sam Bush Blennessy, the chairman of the Northern Land Council.
We're here watching buffalo getting unloaded onto the truck. Yep, one coming down now. Hopefully we'll see more next year.
The trade with Vietnam has turned buffalo into a valuable commodity, and there are now many who want to cash in by getting access to the massive herds of wild buffalo that are roaming Arnhem Land. The Northern Land Council is cautious. It wants to make sure that Indigenous communities in the region get a fair share of the wealth and also get an opportunity to create a sustainable industry. NLC Executive John Christofferson.
I think there's potential for Aboriginal people to become involved in this trade, not as a third-party interest, but as front and centre of the whole buffalo industry chain. I mean, in the short term, you have to understand that there's going to be other people that are going to muster and turn the buffalo off. I would like to think that in the future, when we look at setting up infrastructure with a domestication program, all those sorts of things, that we will be front and centre in all of that.
Because, as you say, there are a lot of buffalo in Indigenous-held lands of the Territory. How much interest is out there in the Indigenous communities to be a part of something like this?
Aboriginal people have been part of the pastoral industry for many, many years. I think there's still a desire for that to continue. However, we are now, with land management issues and the degradation of land by buffaloes, there's two issues that we have to look at. That is land management and the maximum utilisation of the buffalo. Not just shooting them to protect the environment, but perhaps mustering them, turning them off and developing an income.
I noticed one of the annual culls out in the Arafura swamps actually being cancelled to potentially make money out of buffalo instead of shooting them.
Yeah, well, that needs to be looked at further.
Yep.
I understand the need to protect the swamp. It's an important swamp for many reasons, for traditional owners, ecologically and culturally. So that needs to be protected. We need to do the management of the buffalo in that area at a sustainable level. And that means ecologically sustainable, economically sustainable, and socially cultural sustainable. So I'd like to think that when we get back after our full council meeting, we will be on the ball, have somebody out there talking to people about how we can maximise the return on those buffalo.
We're standing here around buffalo from the Territory. Are you happy with how they look and how they're being treated?
They look healthy enough to me. They're treated reasonably well. There's a couple of little things that maybe need to be addressed, you know, like slippery run chutes or something like that. They're little things that can be fixed up, but the overall health of the buffalo is looking good.
The Northern Territory's Minister for Primary Industry and Land Resource Management is Willemstra Van Holter. He's keen to get Indigenous communities involved in the buffalo trade because he can see a number of economic and environmental benefits.
Oh, look, I think there are a couple of really important points here. And one is that buffaloes are feral and they do cause a lot of damage to the landscape. So we have to work out with the Land Council and the traditional owners just how they want to involve themselves in this buffalo industry. Either we're going to get rid of all the buffalo out of particular areas because of their sensitivity, or we're going to have a sustainable harvest. So that's the first thing. But the next thing, of course, is we're very keen for, and we've always said this, about getting regional and remote parts of the Northern Territory up and running as far as their economy goes. And these are opportunities with our buffalo to have real jobs in real businesses, making real wages, and that's got to be better than what's going on out there now, which isn't a heck of a lot.
Is the trade at risk if buffalo can't be accessed out of Arnhem Land?
Oh, look, we've always touted ourselves as stable suppliers of all sorts of livestock, and buffalo is one of those, and that's why we're working very closely now with the NLC and TOs to make sure that we can have a continuity of supply into Vietnam. Look, I think the Vietnamese understand that it's difficult logistically to get the buffalo. Sometimes there aren't going to be as many as they would like, but we have to work all together to make sure that we've got the best possible outcomes we can from the buffalo that we've got.
Minister Willemstra Van Holter, thanks for your time in Haiphong.
Always a pleasure. It's on a cold, rather wet day over here. It's a bit of a far cry from where we would have been in Darwin at about 34 or 35 degrees today.
And look at these buffalo. I might just try ending the story, seeing if I can pat this fella on the head here. So he could come out of the wild, you wouldn't know. Not quite, Minister. He just shied his head only slightly.
But one of the nice things is that these buffalo are actually quite calm. Now, we're standing in amongst, I guess there's probably 100...
There's 100 plus here.
In this stall. They're all got their heads in the feed a lot. There's a couple over there sort of having a bit of a look at us. But these guys are really calm. They're in good nick. They've been dehorned correctly. You can see all that's gone on. You know, this is what is very important, that we work on these animal welfare outcomes as well. Make sure that we're doing the right thing. Make sure our supply chain is doing the right thing. But also just to let the traditional owners know that the animal welfare aspect is covered.
Westra Van Holt ending that report by Matt Brand. Matt is travelling through Vietnam courtesy of the Northern Territory government. Well, let's go from buffalo meat to buffalo milk. Further south, further in Australia's south, there's a growing push to start up a buffalo industry in the dairy heartland of eastern Victoria's Gippsland region. Buffalo milk can fetch as much as 6 times that of cow's milk, and with increasing demand for products like buffalo mozzarella, the local industry is desperate for more supply. Our reporter Jeremy Story Carter caught up with Bruce Murray and his Gippsland buffalo herd to find out why he believes there is a real future for a local buffalo dairy industry.
These buffaloes are riverine. They're not grey like the old swampy buffalo. They're black with shorter horns, and they're actually a milking buffalo.
Buffalo in Victoria, it's not exactly what you'd call an established industry. I guess for you personally, why have buffalo at all?
Well, I was just fascinated by the animal and the way they've acted and what they're all about. And hopefully we can get a bit of an industry started down here of milking buffaloes.
So you think there's a natural potential for that to establish? I mean, we are in dairy country here. So you think that there's a possibility to get a buffalo industry, specifically a buffalo dairy industry, off the ground?
Yes, not a worry in the world, because the buffalo milk is very sought after and it's worth quite good money.
And we'll get into the specifics of that in a moment, but I've got to say, the prospect of milking a buffalo doesn't fill me with a great sense of confidence. Is it an easy task? How similar to milking a dairy cow is it?
I'm told that they're just the same as a dairy cow. You've got to train them like you have to train a heifer to go through the dairy. They're not an animal that gives a lot of milk.
Those horns don't create too much of an issue?
Well, the horns on these riverines are not like you would see on the swampies that are about 3 foot wide or something. These are just a smaller horn, curved horn, goes around the back of the head. They aren't really a problem, apparently.
You've never had a run-in?
I've never had 1 ounce of trouble with a buffalo in the last 8 years. Never been afraid of them yet.
They don't produce a great volume of milk, not like traditional dairy cows have been grown over time to produce, but is it something that can still work on a smaller scale volume?
Yes, the bottom price for the, or the lowest price you'll get for your buffalo milk is around $2.50 a litre, and I do know of people that are getting more than that, and that's a genuine litre.
So that's a pretty big difference to maybe the sort of 20 to 30, 40 cents that a litre that dairy cows might be fetching.
Definitely, it is very good money, and anyone who's got a small property, if they had 60 acres or 50 acres and had a little shed on it or prepared to put a little shed on it, there's no reason why you couldn't milk yourself 20 buffaloes, 30 buffaloes, etc., and make yourself a very tidy living. They don't need any special feed in the bale. The thing that I find they love more than anything is just plain open hay. They love it.
You see this as a specific opportunity to Gippsland, where we already have this dairy culture here, and that it wouldn't take that much to get a buffalo dairy industry off the ground?
No, it'd be quite simple, actually. There is a lot of cheese factories would do anything to get buffalo milk, mainly mozzarella cheese, but the other one is yogurt. They love yogurt and ice cream made out of buffalo milk. And if there was enough buffaloes being milked, there's a very big opportunity for the fresh milk market.
Have you had some fresh buffalo milk?
I have tried fresh buffalo milk, and it's very, very nice.
What about the meat? Because we're seeing in the Northern Territory there's an increased demand moving into Vietnam. There's just been a big order go through there. In terms of meat, is there a potential as well in that avenue?
Meat is a very big avenue. People love the meat. It's actually low in fat and little or no cholesterol, they tell me. And there is a very, very big market, both, I would say, in this country and for export. At the moment, there is a bit of a problem with abattoirs to actually get them killed. But
do you think that if more of an industry around both dairy but also in the buffalo meat in Gippsland, that maybe it might become an appealing and a viable option for a local processor?
Yes, well, at the moment, a lot of bull calves, and there's a lot of those available now. If someone wanted to rear those calves to turn them into meat, there would be, I think, a very, very substantial industry.
So what needs to happen? Does it really just need a kind of grassroots involvement from maybe lower to middle tier in terms of scale dairy farmers to take that plunge and maybe have a little bit of a gamble on a small herd?
I think that's really the way to go. Just start off small. I just think that they're also very viable in there to make some sort of an industry out of them. And I think that's what we actually need in Australia, is to try and build something up.
Bruce Murray talking buffalo with our reporter Jeremy Story Carter. That's on Bruce's Gippsland farm. You're listening to Bush Telegraph.
Hi, Frank Kelly here. Struggling with your Christmas menu? We're here to help. RN Breakfast has a host of culinary greats as this year's Christmas cooks. Massimo Bottura, Peter Gilmore, Stephanie Alexander, Dan Hong, and Yotam Ottolenghi.
I've been testing recipes recently for an alternative Christmas. Rather than a big turkey, I've been cooking Poussin's little baby chicken, cooked with blood oranges, pomegranate molasses, lots of sweet spices.
Yotam Ottolenghi and more. We're really cooking for Christmas here on RN Breakfast.
Right now, you're listening to Bush Telegraph. I'm Cameron Wilson. You're on RN and, of course, Radio Australia as well. Now, in the final weeks, we're down to 2 weeks to go now, final weeks of the program, where asking you to suggest your favourite stories over the years and some new ones as well. We've probably got enough new ones that have come in via Facebook, the email and Twitter now as well. We'll try to get through a handful of them, but there'll be an awful lot we can't get to. My apologies in advance for that, but there's just been a lot of suggestions come in. So thank you for taking the time out. But this one today, this was requested via Facebook by Bob, and Bob wants to hear about Dinky and the day Dinky died. This is the story of Australia's most talented dingo. Some argue that anyway. Dinky, the singing dingo, used to play the piano and sing for tourists in Central Australia. He's in dingo heaven now, but in 2013, our reporter Caddy Brain caught up with Dinky and his owner Jim Cotterill at Stewart's Well Roadhouse.
On any day over the last 12 years, this is the sound you'd probably hear howling out of Jim's place at the Stewart's Well Roadhouse. It would tell you that Dinky, the singing dingo, had hit the keys again to sing to the tourists.
My
This week, the Roadhouse is a far quieter place. Dinkies nowhere to be seen. After 22 years, Jim and his wife Marty have sold the Roadhouse.
Took a few years. We decided some time ago that we should sell it and spend more time together and enjoy life more. But it did take place last week and it's now in new hands.
So 22 years you were at Stewart's Well?
Yeah, it was sort of a mistake, really. So we ended up buying 5 acres with the idea of building a roadhouse, caravan park. And at the time I said to Marty, 5 years, I think that's how long it'll take to set it up. And then we'll sell and I'll move into town. But 5 years dragged out a bit. And Marty, you know what women are like, they're like elephants. I don't mean big and grey. Just have long memories.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Jim, because it wasn't 5 years. It was going to be as soon as we made a profit.
Do you think tourism has changed much over the years, having had a whole career in it in the Northern Territory?
It's changed to a massive degree where people would come here knowing that they were going to experience some hardships. They knew they were dirt roads, maybe even four-wheel drive vehicles in some areas. Camping was certainly a lot more rugged than it is today. The early motels left a lot to be desired. But now it's become a soft tour type thing where people arrive in an air-conditioned plane, they get into an air-conditioned bus on a bitumen road. You know, Ayers Rock used to be a trip where it took 2 days to get there. Now people can go out there and back in one day in a coach. And I think sometimes the impact of the outback has been lost by the fact that people are spending less time actually seeing, and they tend to tick it off. Oh, well, we've been there. We've been to Alice Springs. We've been to the centre. We've been to the territory. But no, it's been a wonderful experience in the bush, meeting some wonderful people, wonderful tourists. Occasionally you'd meet someone and you'd think to yourself, this person should never have left home. You know, they're not with it. And that's what makes it so interesting and so wonderful, being involved in tourism.
Let's talk about Dinky for a moment. Where did Dinky come from, and were his musical talents always apparent from the start?
The local property owner, Orange Creek Station, Wally Klein, was conducting a dingo poisoning program. Wally came across a litter of dingoes, and for whatever reasons known to himself alone, he decided to rescue. I've always found that a funny little story, because he's baiting the older dogs, yet he saved the young ones. And he came to me and said, Jim, I've got these dingo pups. You've got some kangaroos and emus. You need a dingo. So I said, all right, I'll have one. And if our daughters were playing piano, Dinky would stand alongside and throw his head up and give us a bit of a yodel. Then we put a chair alongside the piano and he'd stand on the chair with his front legs up on the keyboard and he'd continue singing. You know, other dogs howl. He doesn't howl. He sings. There is a big difference. So we don't insult him, of course.
Dinky, how old is Dinky now?
Dinky's 13 years old. He's been retired longer than myself. I pensioned him off about 3 or 4 months ago. And mainly because he's suffering with a bit of arthritis in the hips. And this has meant that getting up onto the piano has been a bit of a struggle. And he staggered on the piano a few times. And I thought, well, this has got to stop. Sort of pulled him back and said, no, it's okay. You can retire. You've done well. You've become a wonderful ambassador for tourism and equally a good ambassador for dingoes.
Can we go and see Dinky Jim?
Yes, we can go and see Dinky Jim.
So we're walking inside now.
Come on into the house. Oh, look, there he is. Curled up. I'm not even curled up. He's lying full length on his silk sheet. But as you can see, he's quite comfortable. He's got his legs out there and his head over there and, oh. Are you right there, boy?
Retirement's never looked so good.
I know, we can't actually get him singing to the piano anymore. Ah, oh, Dinky.
Caddy Brain speaking to Jim and Marty Cottrell there at Stewart's Well Roadhouse. That was back in 2013, and that was requested by Bob Shea via our Facebook page. If you want to hear something you've heard over the years on Bush Telegraph, just let us know on social media or via an email. You can find the Contact Us tab on the Bush Telegraph page. Let us know, and we'll do our best to squeeze it in before we wrap up on the 19th of December. We thought we should get Jim back on the phone and see how he's getting on these days. Jim, did that bring back some memories for you?
Oh, yes, it brought a tear to my eyes.
Yeah, how are you getting on since Dinky passed in May, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yes, May this year. His problems were increasing. He was having more difficulty getting around, and obviously it was very uncomfortable. So one evening, he sort of went really downhill, and we called the vet locally here, and it was probably about 9:30 in the evening. We took him over to the clinic, and that was it.
That was it for Dinky. Well, he certainly left an impression, didn't he? Of all the stories we could have had requested for a replay, Dinky's right up there.
Yes, I rang the new owner of the roadhouse, Stewart's Well. His name's Peter Murphy, and that's Murphy's Day, known as Spud. But I rang Peter the next morning and spoke about taking Dinky back down to the roadhouse, and we discussed the location, and by the time I got there, Peter Murphy had dug a hole with the loader and made life very easy for me, and I took Dinky down to the roadhouse and buried him.
So Dinky's at Stewart's Well?
Yes. But he was born not too far from there, sort of across the road on the eastern side of the highway, and that's where he grew up, that's where he performed. And people still actually arrive at the roadhouse, even now, you know, sort of later in the year, they're still rocking up there saying, you know, we've come to listen to Dinky. So some people are not aware that he's
gone.
Died. Others are aware of it, and I intend to put a bit of a headstone on the grave to identify where he now is buried. So he still goes on. The legend goes on. It's wonderful.
How hard was it to choose Stewart's Well, though, as his gravesite, his resting place? You must have been tempted to keep him in the garden at home.
Well, it did cross our minds, but realistically, that's where he lived, that's where he came from, that was his country. And the other thing, of course, you don't always live in the same house, you know, forever. So if we were to move on to another property somewhere, we'd still leave him behind. So take him down to the roadhouse seemed a logical conclusion.
Yeah. Do you visit?
I was down there last Friday, actually. I was driving a vehicle back from Adelaide. Oh, we had two vehicles, two new four-wheel drive buses for our Palm Valley tour next year. And, yes, I called into Stewart's Well, had a cup of coffee and wandered over and had a look at the grave.
Yeah, okay.
That's about the third time I've been back there since he's died.
Yeah. Bit of a trip, isn't it? A few hours down the road from where you are now.
It's less than an hour's drive.
From is it?
So that part's quite easy. Yeah. It's just a matter of having cause or reason to go down that way, if that's anything.
So have you been involved
in tourism.
Yeah,
that's the main thing. My son Craig owns the Alice Wanderer, a tour company in Alice, and does all the tours locally. Ayers Rock, Palm Valley, as I say, we just got two new coaches of that the next year.
Does he have an ambassador as effective as Dinky was for you guys at the roadhouse?
Does Spud, the new owner, have an ambassador?
No, your son. He needs a singing animal.
Spud owns the roadhouse. My son Craig owns the Alice Wanderer. But I do some work with him from time to time, drive a bus or check on things for him. But Spud's actually developing more of a truck stop.
Okay. Jim, have you been tempted at all to get another dingo?
I was actually offered a dingo. I met a lady here in Alice Springs a couple of months after Dinky had died. And the woman was totally aware that I had put Dinky down. And she had two dingoes with her. One was suffering with an abscess tooth. So she was travelling around Australia, but came into us to have the dingo's tooth checked out. And she's been breeding dingoes for a good 40 years. Anyway, she offered me a pup. She said one of her dogs was having a pup shortly. And I said, no, thank you. I'm not going to have another one. And she said, why not? And I said, well, you know, you get to an age where you might die before the dog. And dingoes are particularly affectionate to their owners. They're a family-orientated type of animal. And so if I was to move on, who was going to look after
the Didn't think it was fair to the dingo. To the animal, fair enough, too. So a dinky was it. All right. Okay, thanks, Jim.
So
all the best.
My last one.
Your last one. All the best in the future and good luck.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Cameron.
Jim Cottrell, who's formerly from Stewart's Well Roadhouse and the owner of Dinky, who died earlier this year. Dinky, the singing dingo. That was the story requested via our Facebook page by Bob Shay. If you want to make a request, just let us know. Facebook.com/BushTelegraph or at RNBushTele on Twitter, or you'll find the contact us tape on the top right hand corner of our website. That's it for today. See you at the same time tomorrow. You're on RN.
Hi, it's Michael Cathcart here with another excellent week of stories for you from Books and Arts Daily. Paul Grabowski plays the piano and talks about his music. That's pretty special. Selena Jenkins tells you why she sticks on a big bushy beard before she sings. And I try to convince a Broadway director that Oedipus the Musical is a good idea. And you'll love the show devoted to that classic novel, The Name of the Rose. That's Books and Arts. Download us from the RN website.